watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR, Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW, Kingsville, or WRFN, Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we're pleased to bring you the next class in the Doug Dowd Lecture Series on the USA, where we are, and where we're headed. In this week's episode, he deals with the relationship between capitalism's growth model and environmental destruction. This seems particularly fitting in the wake of the recent passage of the Halliburton-Bechtel Energy Bill that doles out massive subsidies to Cheney's oil buddies who helped write the bill, but does not address in any adequate way wasteful overconsumption, price gouging by oil companies, or the need to move quickly to convert our infrastructure to sustainable energy production. We'll begin the program with an extended report on some particularly egregious aspects of the bill. Then we'll zoom out for the big picture. Dowd's lecture will cast some light on the method behind this madness. Because capitalism must grow to survive, therefore, he who goes extinct with the most toys wins.
The pot-bellied beasts chase their unwelcome guests.
Kelly Ramirez of Global Public Media filed the following report just a week before the energy bill was passed.
Natural gas prices are high. On Friday, July 22nd, the benchmark spot price at Henry Hub, Louisiana, ended the trading week at $7.42 per million BTU. That's well above the $2 to $2.50 range we saw in the 90s. A year and a half ago, Jim Thompson, a natural gas industry analyst with the Energy Information Administration, the EIA, told this reporter that it was doubtful that we would ever see such low prices again.
Our domestic resources are being stretched, you know, to the point where productivity of wells is decreasing. The gas that's going to be coming online over the next 10 or 15, 20 years is going to be harder to recover. It's going to be more expensive to bring to market.
Exactly as conventional economic theory predicts, more drilling has followed in the wake of higher natural gas prices. If the claim of cornucopian economists that more investment will lead to more production of natural resources is true, Americans should be choking on an abundance of natural gas. However, even with the rig count up about 20% over last year, American production has plateaued out. By now, you've probably heard that we are at or very near Hubbert's Peak, the top of the global oil production bell curve. Dale Allen Pfeiffer, author of the book The End of the Oil Age, says that natural gas depletes in a different way than oil, a way that spells trouble for American people and industries dependent on natural gas.
There's a lot less resistance to natural gas moving through the ground. So when natural gas is located in the ground and they begin pumping, the typical curve, if you want to call it that, doesn't resemble the curve of oil. There's more of a ramp up, a rise as production is laid in. That eventually leads to a plateau, which extends for some period of time, and then there is a precipitous cliff, which usually doesn't have much warning.
And how close is U.S. gas production to the cliff?
Well, it could happen at any time.
That was Dale Allen Pfeiffer over a year ago. The news has become more urgent since then. First of all, demand continues to grow. The Energy Information Administration is forecasting that total natural gas consumption in the United States will increase from 22 trillion cubic feet in 2003 to 30.7 trillion cubic feet in 2025. The EIA also says that natural gas is the world's fastest-growing primary energy source. Secondly, George W. Bush has made natural gas a focal point of his overall energy policy. On June 15, 2005, in a speech before the 16th Annual Energy Efficiency Forum, Bush said that to power the growing U.S. economy, America needs to generate more electricity, and that
improving our electricity supply also means making better use of natural gas. The United States has the sixth largest proven reserves of natural gas in the world. We need to increase environmentally responsible production of natural gas from our federal lands.
But just 6 days after that pronouncement, ExxonMobil CEO Lee Raymond told reporters at the Reuters Energy Summit that North American natural gas production has peaked, and that it would be fair to say that production would decline even if the multi-billion dollar McKenzie Valley Pipeline and Alaska Highway Pipeline were built. Note that Raymond referred to North American gas production, not just production in the U.S. Lower 48. David Hughes, a research geologist with the Geological Survey of Canada, agrees with Raymond's assessment. In fact, the figures Hughes cites indicate that Raymond is a bit late in acknowledging North American gas peak.
U.S. gas production peaked in about the second quarter of 2001 and has been going down or remained flat since that time. Canada's gas production hit a plateau in mid-2001. It maintained that plateau until mid-2002, and then despite drilling a record number of holes, production went down about 3.5%. We drilled another record number of holes in 2004, and production has stayed pretty much flat, so we've got no production response from all that extra drilling.
In other words, new investment cannot produce what is not there to begin with. Because of the increased demand and lower production of natural gas in North America, liquefied natural gas, LNG, is expected to become a larger part of the overall natural gas picture over the next 20 years. The United States imports LNG from places such as Trinidad and Tobago, Algeria, and Indonesia on specialized tankers that discharge their cargo in specialized ports. But LNG import terminals are controversial because LNG is highly flammable, and the heat or thermal radiation from an LNG fire can injure people at a considerable distance from the source. People are afraid that an accident or a terrorist attack will cause a great loss of life and property damage if an LNG terminal is sited in a populated area. Even if the terminals are put out to sea, and there is one offshore terminal currently operating in the Gulf of Mexico, some people fear that marine life will be harmed by the use of large amounts of seawater to warm the LNG back to its gaseous state for injection into pipelines. So whenever LNG terminals are proposed, they meet with state and local opposition. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, maintains maps of proposed LNG projects on its website, www.ferc.gov. David Hughes has noticed that the number of proposals fluctuates.
I've tracked the FERC map, and they were updating that map every 2 weeks for quite a bit of the last year. And it's interesting to note the proposals that fell off the table. I counted 13 proposals that were canceled over a 13-month period that ended in March of this year. And it was really interesting because I pulled up the May 17th version of that map, and the number of LNG proposals had dropped from 56 in March to 38 in May. A lot of that is public opposition.
One of the best-known defeats of an LNG project came in January of 2003, when Bechtel and Shell withdrew their proposal for an LNG terminal on the site of a former naval shipyard at Mare Island in Vallejo, California, a suburb of San Francisco. The withdrawal came just 9 months after the proposal had been announced. Elena Ducharme, who chaired Vallejo for Community Planned Renewal, the community group formed to block the LNG project, says opposition in Vallejo was formidable.
There was the relentlessness and dedication and commitment of the group, and that was actually a bigger and more dedicated group than you might typically get in certain environmental issues or certain other kind of local issues, partly because It was a single project. It was easy to focus on. It was easy to keep our sights on our end goal. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, I think these things work together, but they were both very important, was the gut-level reaction that your average resident had toward the project. Probably 80 to 85% of the people that we talk to every week at the farmers market were immediately like, yuck, no, bad idea, too close, we're looking right over at it, it's going to be potentially dangerous, it's going to put out pollution, why here?
Weavers Cove Energy and its partner Hess LNG are facing stiff opposition in Fall River, Massachusetts, a town of about 92,000 people near the Massachusetts-Rhode Island border. The energy companies have proposed to site an LNG terminal in an area of Fall River formerly used by Shell Oil. The proposal has been approved by FERC on the condition that certain mitigation measures be implemented during construction and operation, and that the companies also implement a Coast Guard security plan. But opponents in Massachusetts and Rhode Island have been saying that the site is too close to residences, schools, and businesses to be safe. So State Representative David Sullivan, Democrat of Fall River, introduced Massachusetts House Bill 1418, called An Act Regulating Liquefied Natural Gas Tank Import Terminals. The bill requires that LNG import terminals and tankers maintain certain minimum distances from human developments such as homes, schools, and hospitals. The bill is now in committee. Sullivan thinks the states have the power to regulate terminal and tanker clearances.
It is mine and a number of other people's belief that our Constitution, the Massachusetts Constitution, Article 106, basically gives us a mandate to protect people's public safety and to protect their property. And I believe that that is a state sovereign right, and I don't believe that the federal government has the right to intrude in that area.
But Gordon Shearer, CEO of Weavers Cove Energy, noted that a similar bill had been dropped in Rhode Island on advice of counsel. Shearer says he does not think that state efforts to regulate LNG importation would pass muster under the federal constitution.
The safety and security of ships in foreign commerce and in under federal jurisdiction is a subject for the federal government, not the states.
Even in state waters?
Absolutely. It's the foreign commerce of the United States. It's reserved to the federal government under the United States Constitution. It has been for decades, probably centuries, actually. In fact, Massachusetts has passed a separate enforcement bill to try and govern the tug and barge towing operations in parts of Massachusetts and impose regulations that are different than that imposed by the federal government. And that's not foreign commerce, that's domestic commerce. And the federal government has sued Massachusetts as being in violation of the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution.
The Center for Public Integrity has obtained LNG-related documents from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission through a Freedom of Information Act request. According to the center, FERC has met privately at least 83 times with representatives of oil and gas companies active in the LNG market, while having only a handful of such meetings with LNG opponents. And George W. Bush wants to short-circuit local opposition to LNG terminals.
And to further increase our natural gas supply, Congress needs to make clear federal authority to choose sites for new receiving terminals for liquefied natural gas.
The Energy Policy Act of 2005, called H.R. 6 in the House and S.10 in the Senate, states that FERC, quote, shall have the exclusive authority to approve or deny an application for the siting, construction, expansion, or operation of facilities located onshore or in state waters for the import of natural gas from a foreign country or the export of natural gas to a foreign country, unquote. Tamara Young-Allen is a spokesperson for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
The Congress asked the Commission what improvements the Commission would like to see in the Natural Gas Act, which is the statute by which the Commission operates and gives the Commission authority over natural gas facilities. And our staff suggested that the language be clarified that FERC has exclusive jurisdiction over these facilities. We feel that it currently grants us that right, but we wanted it to state it more clearly. The Commission feels that the current jurisdiction would stand, it's just that the language and the rule would be clarified. That is, the Commission has authority to oversee, has the authority to grant the right to companies to construct and operate facilities that would provide for natural gas, provide for the transportation and storage of natural gas, including the exportation and importation of natural gas, which is essentially what LNG facilities do.
FERC insists that the energy bill does not take away states' rights under federal law to have a say in the siting of LNG terminals in their jurisdictions. Again, FERC spokesperson Tamara Young-Allen.
The Commission is not contemplating taking away states' rights. For instance, there is no move or no request by this Commission to remove state rights under the U.S. Clean Air Act, for instance, which is administered by the Environmental Protection Agency. We're not asking to remove states' rights under, for instance, the Coastal Zone Management Act, which is administered by the U.S. Commerce Department. Nor are we, for instance, seeking to remove state authority under the U.S. Clean Water Act, which is administered by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We're only requesting that the language in the statute by which we operate would expressly say that the Commission has the authority over the siting and the operation of importation and exportation facilities, including LNG.
But it's important to know what Young-Allen is not saying. These states' rights currently apply only to LNG facilities that are over 3 miles offshore. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California observed that the energy bill gave governors no authority to veto projects in ports or near closely packed communities. So she spearheaded a bipartisan effort in the United States Senate to give states an equal say with the federal government over the siting of LNG terminals. In May, Feinstein issued a statement saying that, quote, liquefied natural gas has an important role to play in our nation's energy future. It is imperative to clarify who has the authority to move LNG projects forward so that the federal government can guarantee access to energy and states can ensure that citizens are safe and protected from hazard, unquote. Feinstein's amendment was intended, among other things, to provide governors with 45 days to approve, veto, or attach conditions to a project after FERC issues its final environmental impact statement. It also would have allowed states to impose and enforce even more stringent safety requirements on LNG terminals than those required by the federal government. In another statement issued in June, Feinstein wrote that the amendment was intended to provide states with a real veto authority if a project were to violate the state's environmental protection, land and water use, public health and safety, and coastal zone management laws. Feinstein's principal co-sponsor was Republican Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine. Over a year ago, the residents of Harpswell, Maine, defeated an LNG proposal by ConocoPhillips and TransCanada, despite strong support from members of the town council. Chris Duval was one of the founding members of the opposition group Fair Play for Harpswell.
They dropped this proposal for a massive LNG terminal on the town, and a group of citizens immediately formed who were instantly opposed to this because it was just way out of character for our town, which is a small fishing village on the coast of Maine, and to try to insert a massive industrial complex in the middle of it was insanity, we felt. Houses would be rendered unlivable, as well as a rich lobstering area in Middle Bay, which is a part of Casco Bay in Harpswell, would have been just wiped out. It would have put 40 or 50 fishing families out of business. The lure they offered was basically to pay the town's entire budget for every year for the next 50 years, which is about $8 million a year. So the taxes would have been drastically reduced. But we just didn't feel even that is worth. Why would we want to harm our neighbors and friends and the fishermen who make up the soul of our community just to lower our taxes? It made no sense. And as well as introduce a facility which would be dangerous and polluting and everything else in our midst.
Senator Snowe may very well have had Harpswell in mind when she spoke on the floor of the Senate in favor of the Feinstein Amendment.
Over this past year in Maine, the controversial siting of LNG facilities has found both support and opposition. finding some residents supporting a substantial source of economic development and revenues, and others opposed because of concern about a potential terrorist target, interference with the lobster industry, navigation, and the spoiling of coastal vistas and land values. Each community has had the opportunity to have had its say through referendums. I have had great concerns about handing this very siting decision solely over to a federal agency and feel very strongly that there should be a process in place where the governor, speaking for the people of Maine, must have an equal opportunity to democratically place a voice to what happens in their own backyard. In its current form, the energy bill before us gives exclusive authority to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in selecting LNG sites. This would effectively eliminate any input from state governments into the selection of these locations. Moving total control to FERC transfers an enormous power to an unelected federal agency which has no accountability to the local communities affected. Without the amendment, local sentiments will go unheard or be simply ignored. To force upon a state and a local community to exclude them from the process is clearly unwise. Within our union of states, unique state concerns must be recognized in federal government decisions. It is a states' rights issue, plain and simple.
The Feinstein Amendment was defeated by a vote of 52 to 45. The progress of the energy bill is being watched by LNG opponents in Astoria, Oregon, a town of about 10,000 people near the mouth of the Columbia River, about 100 miles from Portland. Commercial and recreational fishing, forest products, and more recently tourism are the bulwarks of the local economy. The Port of Astoria granted a 65-year lease on public land to California's Calpine Corporation to build an LNG terminal. But Astoria native Peter Hutala of the local group Columbia River Vision says the terminal is not yet a done deal.
Although the corporation has control of the property, they still need to go through various permitting processes. And at this time, there's still local land use permitting processes and state energy facility siting council process. Now, the reality is that both the state and local processes could be usurped by the federal government if the energy bill passes with provision giving sole siting authority to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
If that happens, Hutala says opponents of the Astoria project would still continue to fight.
There still is a process at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and an environmental impact statement and the like. We're prepared to fight this project and any other LNG project in the Lower Columbia River through federal channels, through a political means as much as possible. Actually, in a sense, the federal government taking sole siting authority to themselves actually helps us in an odd way in bringing us more allies in the state and local politicians who really think this is the federal government overstepping the bounds. Governor Kulongowski of Oregon has expressed real anger at the prospect of the federal government taking sole siting authority. The local communities in the states should have something to say about the safety, security of their citizens and the changes to our economic and social structure here.
Southern California attorney Tim Riley and his wife Hayden are fighting all proposals for LNG projects in North America, from Oxnard, California to the Bahamas. Tim Riley thinks the energy bill will stifle local voices. Riley says that Section 320 of H.R. 6, the House version of the energy bill, indicates the federal government's intention to control the siting of LNG terminals.
They're trying to lock in absolute federal jurisdiction and control over the siting of LNG. The language, if you look under the Section 320 where it says Section E, state and local considerations, all they say is they quote-unquote shall consult with the state. If they feel so strongly about it, perhaps the Senate should change that language and say that the states will have jurisdiction and the states shall consult with the federal government. See how they feel comfortable when it's on the other foot. And when you want to know in terms of how far that consulting goes to, the bottom line under the authorities of the state pursuant to the 320 says basically that once the matter's been set for hearing, the federal government will give the interested parties, which includes the states, notice of the hearing, and that's basically it. How far it goes in terms of safety considerations? Well, let me read to you Section II, State Safety Inspections. The state commission of the state in which the liquefaction or gasification natural gas terminal is located may, after the terminal is operational, conduct safety inspections. And it goes on to say that the inspections have to be pursuant to notice to the federal government. They have to be in conformance with federal regulations and federal guidelines. So basically, the states put on notice that there's going to be a hearing, that the federal government's considering putting an LNG facility in your state and locality, and the authority you have is, we'll talk to you about it, and you're not even going to be able to inspect the thing until after, and you're going to have to use all our federal guidelines, and basically it's a toothless law for you because it's going to be pursuant to our federal safety guidelines. What they did was they amended the act to give the FERC authority over specifically LNG siting facilities. That's what the Section 320 does. And the only authority they leave to the state is they say, quote unquote, we shall consult.
The energy bill is in a House Senate conference committee where it has died in previous years. However, many people believe the bill has its best chance of final passage this year. For Global Public Media, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
And that story was filed late last month. Since then, the energy bill has passed. What the passage of the bill also means is that they are going to try to construct new nuclear power plants, which is perhaps the most terrifying feature of this bill of all. Did you know that all a nuclear power plant does is boil water to turn a turbine to make electricity? It is the least efficient and most dangerous method of boiling water that there is. The wind can turn a turbine to make electricity, harmlessly. What can they be thinking? Next, Professor Doug Dowd will address that question. The wastefulness of our society is not an accident or an oversight. It is a prerequisite for maintaining the capitalist system, which requires constantly increasing growth and constantly increasing use of resources, which places it on a collision course with survival. For those of you new to the program, since the spring we've been running a bi-weekly class lecture with economist Doug Dowd. Each year he gives a free public course on political economy in San Francisco. Dowd is the author of many books and has a career spanning more than half a century as an academic and an activist. Now, Professor Doug Dowd.
So tonight we'll talk about the environment. I want to say that in the first place, pretty much everything I have to say about this is already on the website of the class. Under the What's New, Broken Promises of America book, one of the selections that's on the website is the environment. Secondly, I want to say that I'm positive that everybody in this room already has a sensible attitude toward what's a sensitive and informed attitude about what's happening about the environment and what we are as a nation not doing about it or doing about it. I'm not going to say anything that's entirely new to you, but the purpose of these classes always has been to try, sort of an egotistical thing on my part, for me to try to make you, who are already well-informed, better informed, so that if and when you try to make any arguments politically, you can make them better. And secondly, that you'll realize even more than you have realized just how badly things are going, really, really badly. And least of all, I should say, least of all do you not know how dangerous the environment has become. In the first place, I think that it's much worse than everyone is saying because predictions, scientific predictions, which are bad enough, are always made very cautiously because they don't want to be thought of as being fools or anything like that. Negative, anything negative, I can say as an old professor, people who are in the intellectual community hate like hell to say anything negative, and they love very much to say things that are positive. If you're positive and you're wrong, no problem. But if you make a negative sort of a statement and you're found out to be wrong, then you're really hooted out of the hooted out of the room. So there's a real tendency to be very conservative when it comes to negative kinds of things. And my own judgment is that things are much, much worse than they seem, and much, much worse than the scientists are saying, and totally irreversibly worse than what the government of the United States is saying. And even the governments that are, for example, participating in the Kyoto Pact, and that's almost all the governments, are being dangerously cautious. The Kyoto Pact, if it were to be signed by everybody and go into, and everybody lived up to it to the letter, we would still be in dire trouble within 20 years. Dire trouble. Because all they're doing is saying, in effect, slow down the rate of the increase of the problem. And the kinds of things they're pointing to are only part of the problem, for the one thing. Secondly, slowing down the rate isn't enough. It's just a question of whether the disaster is going to come X years from now or X minus 4 years from now or X plus 4 years. So let's take a look at the whole thing. What you're talking about when you're talking about the environment is what the Greeks were talking about, earth, air, fire, and water. That's what they began to talk about this a long time ago. And in all four of those elements, especially if in fire we include internal combustion and all the things that are worked by power of one sort or another, whether it's electric power, coal, fossil fuels, or whatever the hell it is, we mean by that fire. Earth, air, fire, and water, everything is in dire, dire trouble. And one of the big troubles surrounding all of those troubles is that there has been a fog of argument, or I should say been there a set of arguments for a long time now, decades, which say, well, the trouble is, and what they point to is what is not the trouble. The trouble is there are too many people, for one thing. I'm going to look at both of these things very briefly. The trouble is modern technology requires us, but it doesn't. The trouble is with the system, and I don't want to sound old-fashioned lefty and all that sort of thing, but it is the system. There's never been a really sensible, decent social system, except for a couple that were destroyed by everything that ensued after them. I mean, for example, what we call the Indians in the United States really had a good social system, and there's a good literature on that. I don't want to go into it. It's just every time I read that literature or parts of it, I almost weep because of what was lost when the Europeans came to this hemisphere. Not only, but especially the people who became what we call ourselves, Americans. But also, I used to teach about Southeast Asia, including, of course, Vietnam. So I know something about Vietnam's older history, before the French got there, way before the French got there. It was a marvelous society. I mean, you know, the Vietnam War was bad enough, but what the French and then the Japanese and especially we destroyed, it's just heartbreaking. They had something like a genuine democracy in what we call, and what they never called, Vietnam. There were dozens and dozens of what we would call tribes, or what the American Indians would call nations, and so on. And they ruled themselves, and there was a sense of equality there. And then there was Iceland, way out in the middle of an ocean someplace, all by itself. Veblen wrote a book about Iceland. He called it the Icelandic Saga, or the Something Saga, which he translated all their stuff. And they had a genuinely democratic society there, a republic, so to speak, until the Vikings came. You understand? And so I don't know about Africa. I don't know about the rest of the world. All I know is about those places, and the places I know about were all pre any kind of invasion of the European. We start talking about the Europeans from the time that we know about them. I don't care whether we're talking about Greeks, Persians, Romans, Italians, French, English, and so on. But there's something about the Western European and East Mediterranean European societies that made them behave in such a fashion whenever they began to make any kind of technological advancement at all, to use it in such ways that abused or desecrated or eliminated other people or their own people. That is to say, there's a power drive in our, let's call it Western culture, wasn't existent in the worlds that we conquered. Whether you can say that that was true of the Asian civilization, I don't know. I don't know enough about ancient China or ancient India. But I know about the Western world. And whenever there was a technological development, it was always used in such a fashion as to destroy, to the gain of those who had power. And those people who had power in what was our ancient world and became our medieval world and became our modern world was always those people who first and foremost originally controlled war and secondly controlled production, ownership production. And I have to say here parenthetically that I don't think this is just a personal feeling on my part. I don't think you can rise to power unless you are demented. I mean that word seriously, unless you need power in order to live as you wish to live. Needing power means control over other people. That's what power is. Control over other people and, of course, whatever the assets of your society are. And people who need that have something really demented about them. There's something wrong with them. And that then begins to trail itself out into everything in the society. In Veblen, not this little doggy, but Thorstein Veblen wrote a book which you all should try to read. It's called The Instinct of Workmanship. It's his study of human nature, in which he makes a distinction between those tendencies that are in all of us and the tendencies he's talking about, whether they're for better or for worse, are in all of us. Those tendencies that allowed our species to survive, he puts into his way of using words the instinct of workmanship, which is dominated by what he calls the maternal bent, which can be called, translated in more general terms, into the communal bent, versus what he calls the instinct of sportsmanship, which is all competitive, violent, militaristic. And of course, the instinct of work of sportsmanship allowed the species to survive also. You understand? When you go back to the beginning of the species, you couldn't sit around a fire if it had a fire and be nice with each, just be gentle and friendly and cooperative people because there were enemies around you, whether they were animals or other peoples who were searching for food or whatever. So that the maternal bent, the instinct of workmanship, was essential for our survival, so was the other instinct. Okay? But it is in the very nature of these kinds of, both of these bents or instincts on our part, that the one that was most ferocious would win, the one that was best armed. Veblen, in his own anthropological inquiries, also points out that the first private property was women, slaves, captured in battle, made into slaves. You can think about that, fellas, as you next time you look in the mirror, up or down, and so on and so on and so on. So when you get into the medieval and then the early modern period, when banking and shipping and colonialism begin, then of course the people who are running those adventures are going to be the people who are going to dominate. Now what Veblen argued, and he's not alone in this, John Dewey says the same thing, Freud says very much the same thing, Marx says very much the same thing. If you say that there are two sets of, quote, instincts in us, what Veblen called the constructive instinct and the destructive instinct, or the competitive, if there are two sets of them, then how are they going to move through time in us? It depends upon the society you're living in, all these people would say, and I would agree, certainly. It depends upon the socialization process. And the socialization process has become skewed over the past several thousand years, but especially the past 1,000 years, and especially the past 300 or 400 years, by the militarism, the aggressiveness, and the last few hundred years, capitalism, which combines all of these awful tendencies in us, puts them together into really a powerful unit of socialization. And that socialization process, however powerful it was, let's say, in the 18th century, in the 19th century, when the people, the ordinary people of the time in that country that became the first real capitalist country, Britain, had their land taken away from them, had their livelihood taken away from them, had to work in the workhouses in what Blake called those dark, satanic mills, where families were splintered deliberately, where children, women, their mothers and their fathers all worked, but separately, kept separate. And this we're talking about millions of people now. The people who had been the yeomanry, the proud yeomanry, of which is celebrated in the poetry of England. They became, finally, wage slaves. And the socialization process that goes on from with that and after that, and with the people who were enviable in a society, were the people at the power. But in our time, it isn't just that. In our time, the socialization process is very, very much magnified, made much more powerful through modern communications and education, what we call education, not just through the media, through what goes on and what does not go on in the schools. I can't remember, I don't think any of you can remember, anything but a sliver the whole time, my whole educational process, until the university, when there was ever anything said about our society that was not praising it, where there was ever anything said about human needs, about human possibility, nothing ever, anything. I went to school in San Francisco, not in Jackson, Mississippi. We weren't taught to think about our society. We were taught to accept our society. Understand? And that's what goes on. And my own daughter now teaches elementary school in California. And she tells me the struggle she has. She's not a firebrand. She's just a decent person. She tells me the struggle she has trying to teach sensibly to her little kids who are all second, third year school, second, third grade. Same thing was in high school. And I didn't learn anything after high school until I happened to go to junior college in San Francisco. And I learned from one man who'd lost a leg in World War I. And he was really pissed off. And so he began to talk. The class I was taking from him was a sociology class. But he taught me history. He taught me to think in historical terms. He was just angry as hell all the time. And that's what woke me up. That plus the waterfront strike and a lot of other things that were going on in the world. One person out of all the teachers I had until I was about 20 years old. One person. Then I began to look for other people like that and found a few of them after World War II at Berkeley. Now, I don't think I'm below average in this respect. I think I was luckier than most because I found one person, okay, who was the way he was because he had a leg chopped off. I don't know what he would have been like if that hadn't happened to him. And if that hadn't happened to him, I don't know what I would have been like. Maybe, maybe not. Marx didn't have everything to say that should be said, and everything that he said, not all of it should have been said. But he was if I may use the right words, he was a genius on the side of human beings. And he saw things way back then, whether it was in before he ever wrote the Communist Manifesto with Engels, that is to say, his philosophical manuscripts. You should read those. 1843, 1844, where he talks about alienation, where he talks about, in 1844, he's talking about consumerism. He doesn't use that word. And he's not talking about consumerism in the sense that we mean everybody with automobiles and this sort of stuff. He's talking about how a capitalist society is a society which monetarizes everything, which takes the soul or the meaning out of everything, and its meaning is entirely found in its ability to make profit, and so on. He talks about the alienation of the worker and the alienation of the worker as a consumer, as a person. This is before the Communist Manifesto. In the Communist Manifesto, he had, along with Engels, this to say about technology. This is an old thing. Most of you have read it. Heard it, but it never can be forgotten in terms of especially our times, which are going absolutely insane in the way he's talking about. The bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production and with them the whole relations of society. That's a pretty heavy sentence. Very, very beautiful sentence. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of existence for all earlier industrial classes. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguished the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast-frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man at last is compelled to face with sober senses his real condition of life and his relations with his kind. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. Globalization. That's what he said. Then he went on to say this now in Capital, talking about how technology is misused and how we are misused. In modern agriculture, he said, as in the urban industries, the increased productiveness and quantity of the labor set in motion are bought at the cost of laying waste and consuming by disease labor power itself. Moreover, all progress in the art, not only of robbing the laborer, but of robbing the soil, all progress in increasing the fertility of the soil for a given time is a progress towards ruining the lasting sources of that fertility. The more a country starts its development, get this, 1867, the more a country starts its development on the foundations of modern industry, like the United States, for example, he said in Capital, the more rapid is this process of destruction. Capitalist production, therefore, develops technology and the combining together of various processes into a social whole only by sapping the original sources of all wealth, the soil and the laborer. It's enough to make a Marxist out of you. So let's talk a little bit about that. I said something about our species before in survival. One of the things that's most marvelous about us is also our major, also a major cause of our disaster. We are the only species that has the ability to imagine with any strength at all. I mean, if you've ever had a dog or a cat or even an alligator as a pet, you'll know that other creatures also imagine, but within limits like this, whereas our imagination is quite literally unbounded. And we utilize it for everything, for what we create and for what we destroy. It took a lot of imagination to destroy Hiroshima. It took a lot of imagination to develop medicines. It took a lot of imagination to get Beethoven's Ninth Symphony into existence, and so on. It took a lot of imagination for the Nazis to do what they did. The Holocaust took imagination. Iraq took imagination. Imagination is to think of doing something that doesn't exist. And we are the only species that can do that beyond a certain minimal point. I mean, a dog can hear a noise and imagine in such a fashion that one of the things that imagination does to us, which is it causes us to fear, happens just like that for a dog. So they bark, at least our dog barks. But they can also wag their tail in imagination when they hear a certain noise or so on. Imagination is a source of hope, of fear. In some sense or another, it's very much connected with love and hate. There's always something unrealistic about love, and there's always something unrealistic about hate. Well, it's giving attributes that don't exist to the person you hate, black or white or green, whatever it is, and so on. So as a species, we're able, our imagination makes it possible for us to do things that are either beneficial or harmful, that no other species does to itself. You take a little beaver cutting down trees, they cut down trees in an area about this size. You know, we cut down forests, not just forests. We destroy quasi to almost everything, to one degree or another. So far as I know, we're the only species that is self-destructive, however, except the lemmings. And we laugh at the lemmings that go jumping over those cliffs. They don't do it all the time. And they're only one species. So are there too many people? Let me turn away from technology. The problem is not technology. The problem is what technology has been used for and why it has been used for what it's been used for and why it hasn't been used for what it could be used for. There's nothing wrong with the basic inventions, except, I would say, nuclear inventions. I think those are fundamentally wrong in the sense that there's no way you can use them at all for peaceful purposes or wartime purposes without doing vast damage, because there's no way of getting rid of nuclear waste that we know about, except to bury it, and then it doesn't get buried properly, or except to put it in Idaho, and they don't want it there, except to put it here or put it there or put it somewhere. There's no way to get rid of it. So, but apart from that, I can't think of anything that was ever invented, including TNT, that can't be used usefully, peacefully, in a worthwhile fashion. Nor can I think of anything except a few things, technological advances, that were used mostly for only good purposes. It's very hard to find anything. It's the system. The system does not... The system allows things to happen, but then when they are made practical and become normal, it's because they are profitable. There are some exceptions, but they don't last for very long. Healthcare, we can say pharmaceuticals, hooray, but... And it isn't as though some of us, including you and some of us in this room, haven't benefited from pharmaceuticals. It's that by and large, the pharmaceutical industry, no matter what it invents, no matter where it invents them, has in this country, under capitalist conditions, done more harm than good in the sense that the pharmaceutical products cost so much that they become part of a malign healthcare system in which the cost of healthcare goes up astronomically for reasons that have to do nothing with the things that are at stake in themselves. They have to do with who's selling them, what they're doing in order to sell them and sell them. And so the whole thing is obscenely rotten. As for health care, I just want to say something. This, again, is a personal item. Because of what's happened to me recently, as you know, I've had lots of examinations. Two times I had to go to emergency. I was in emergency the first time for a couple of hours, mostly just sitting there. I was in there for an hour the second time, mostly just sitting there. I received in the mail itemized amount that cost. For the first visit, it was $980. For the second visit, it was $560. What they did was to put a bandage on my thumb, which was very badly, because I had fallen down because of this neuropathy. A bandage on my thumb. $1,500, because I had to go back a second time. Now, that didn't cost me anything, because I have Medicare and I have very generous health care provision for my California pension. It might cost me a few bucks. But if somebody had been exactly me without that stuff, in the first place they would have been turned away, because the first thing they say to you is, give us your medical cards. And if you don't have them, maybe they'll take you and charge you. Maybe they'll send you to some other hospital, because there are fewer and fewer hospitals that have emergency rooms now, as you may know. This is not something that is ideologically wrong. This is something that's simply criminal. It's just criminal. It's all there is to it. If it were you or your mother or your wife or your child, you'd say, it's a crime. You'd want to kill these bastards. Except the bastards who are doing this are not the ones that are making the money. Somebody else is making the money. And so on. So let's go on now. When I say, talk about this whole thing, one of the things that's really remarkable in the scientifically advanced world of ours is it wasn't until about mid-century, last century, that there began to be any public awareness, I should say awareness in people, among professional people, about environmental dangers. The first book I know about There was one book on resources that came out in the 1940s, which didn't concern itself with environmental damage, but did indicate that there was a shortage of things coming up, or too much of this, too little of that. But the first book I'm aware of, and I am an economist who studies economics, the first book I was aware of came out in 1950, I think it was 1956 or something like that. It was called The Social Costs of Private Enterprise. The Social Costs of Private Enterprise. And what he was talking about, his name was Cap. He was an American citizen, but from Europe. What he's talking about is, if you have a plant that's spewing out smoke, if you have a plant that's putting poisonous water into a river or into a lake, who pays for that? The social costs are high. What are the costs to the business that is doing that and not paying for that? And this is so characteristic of the United States, among other places, that the costs that are due to the society, the costs of pollution, the costs of the waste and so on, I mean, the list would be as high as the ceiling here of the things that are social costs. Those are paid for not by the company that profits from using things like this and doing things like this. They're paid for by the society in terms of the damage it does, and also paid for quite literally in terms of taxes that have to be paid for, let's oversimplify, cleanup. And one of the things that the present administration is doing, and all it's doing is purposely doing by intention what was done by lack of attention in previous administrations. What it's doing is saying that those costs should not be paid by the criminal, but by the victim. This is what they're doing with respect to their energy, their new energy law, and so on and so on. And they're getting away with it. It's just extraordinary. It isn't extraordinary. It's explicable. You can explain it jot and tittle. You can say this kind of money was given to this administration by that oil company, that steel company, this other company, these lobbyists, and so on. That's explicable. But it's extraordinary that it can go on and on and on and on to a society of people, most of whom are literate, most of whom are paying for this in their lives, in their noses, in their hearts, in their lungs, and cheering or looking the other way, and so on. Well, let's start taking a look at some of this stuff. As I say, you know mostly all about it anyway, and I'd like to see if we can get a discussion of, well, what can we do, what must we do, and what other kinds of things that might be worth discussing as you see it. But I'd like to just do something by, so to speak, by classification. I don't want to go into the details, but if we look at earth, air, fire, and water, we look at earth, we're talking about the soils, but the soil. We're talking about forests. We're talking about the sorts of things that are there, nature provided. It was in 1962 that Rachel Carson wrote her book called Silent Spring. What she was writing about in 1962 was the poisoning of trees and of the earth, which was killing off birds because they eat stuff on these trees and eat stuff. Silent Spring. And that's all she was talking about. She was a scientist, and her book created quite a fuss. And then time went by, and she became famous and began writing articles, and books were written about her and so on. And much later, when a book came out about her, with articles about her, she wrote for that book, she wrote this. She said, earlier, she had not worried that nature, I'm quoting her, actually needed protection from men. But she added, I'm quoting, I was wrong. Even those things that seem to belong to the eternal verities are not only threatened, but have already felt the destroying hand of man. Today we use the sea as a dumping ground for radioactive waste. This was 30 years ago. It's even worse now. For dumping radioactive waste, which then enter the vast and uncontrollable movements of ocean water through the deep basins to turn up no one knows where. The once beneficent rains are now an instrument to bring down from the atmosphere the deadly products of nuclear explosions.